CliffCentral.com.
All right, it is time for the Burning Platform, which is this morning with Lito Ndoba. Lito, it's nice to see you, man. How are you?
Morning, guys. I'm good, and yourself?
Good. Pumi and I have
Hello.
We've been excited to see you. It's been a little while. First of all,
yes.
How bad is it in Velkom as compared to everywhere else when the water doesn't work? I mean, the electricity doesn't work and the water doesn't work, because we know you have problems with both.
So in the township, when load shedding comes, so let's assume like there's a two hour difference.
Yeah.
In the township, it goes for like 4 to 6 hours at times. There's a neighborhood called Bronville where all the colored people were placed, and at times they haven't had electricity for like 4 or 5 days in a row. So,
Jesus,
it's that bad. And at times, there's no water. Like,
yeah.
If you go to Bronville now, the water pressure is nothing. Like, you have to wait like an hour for your bath to fill up so that you can take a bath. So,
I knew you'd have a horrible story for us, because we always start talking to you about the horrible stories of what goes on in a place like Velkom. I mean, is anything on the improvement track there? Because we know a lot of people just want to get out. Last time we spoke to you, you pretty much said you're going to give up on the place, even though you've been trying. You've got students you've been trying to help. This is your community. You've been trying to make a difference. We know that you've been putting in a lot of effort behind the scenes. You probably do even more than you could talk about. But is there a reason to stick around? Has anything got better? Are there politicians being held accountable? Am I talking nonsense here? Am I just hoping against hope?
This is what we do, right, as South Africans. We're always hoping for something, hoping about anything, right? But in this place, like, you know, when I started to think that maybe ACE was better than the people who were here, that's when I thought, yeah, everything has gone down the toilet. Because I think if you watch Carte Blanche like a week or two ago, they were talking about the roads in the Free State.
Mm.
They literally had a convoy of nice big cars go and see what potholes are there and say, we promised to fix these potholes.
Yeah, wasn't you could just go and wasn't Figile Mbalula was there, wasn't he?
Yes, and yeah. Then somebody from the presidency was here, and they had a big convoy to go hand over one house in Allen Ridge. One house. So,
but he did also say, Cyril Ramaphosa, a week and a half ago at a, I don't remember where he was presenting, but at least he was awake, unlike yesterday at the...
But I digress.
He did say, though, that, you know, that Eskom should stop being discriminatory with load shedding schedules.
Yeah, yeah.
He said the townships
are bearing an unequal amount of the weight when it comes to load shedding. And he was doing this. Now, I, first of all, don't believe that anyone in the townships is stupid enough to swallow up these platitudes. You can tell he's only saying this because he's trying to curry favor with poor people and make it sound like someone else is victimizing them. Meanwhile, we know the whole reason any of this is going on is because his government's so cuck at their jobs.
Yes. If we're being honest, the reason why Eskom is taking liberties with Velkom, they know you're not going to complain because we still owe them 5 billion rand. So they know you have no leg to stand on because here's the argument that our government had against Eskom, right? They say to Eskom, no. You also owe us money. Ever since democracy came about, you've had substations on government land. So we assume you owe us 200 million rand. And Eskom says, you owe us 5 billion. What's 200 million rand to 5 billion?
How, guys? Velkom also owes Eskom. I thought it was just Soweto.
No.
All right.
Everyone in the Free State owes Eskom to the event where Malutia Pofunso, the municipality in Kwakwa, Eskom went and repossessed. Yeah, Eskom repossessed the furniture inside the municipality.
No.
Yes, that's terrible.
If you go to Malutia Pofung, everyone works from home. There's no furniture.
Unbelievable. Now that municipality should just be dissolved. I mean, they don't do anything. right? They can't do anything from home. A municipality needs to be in a place. They need to be able to connect water, lights. They need to be able to collect revenues. They need to be able to go door to door. I mean, this is outrageous. How can you in a municipality not exist except virtually, especially in a place where a lot of people in that community don't even have internet?
I went there to go help the TVET sector debate, I think 2 weeks ago. I got there and the lights were off. So I asked the people in the taxi I'm with, look, how long do the lights go off? They said, oh, no, could be a week, could be 3 weeks.
Jesus.
Just get ready. And so you think about it and you're like, there are people who are living worse. I complain about Welcome. There are people who are living worse than I am now.
Yeah.
And that's what we're all going to eventually if we don't stop these people.
All right, so let's talk about that for a second, because you've been speaking to a lot of people. You've been attending these lectures and debates and things. Governance in South Africa, has it reached the bottom yet? I mean, we talk about, you know, investments and currencies and Bitcoin reaching the bottom. And people go, oh, well, if we're dragging ourselves along the bottom, then you buy now. So it can only go up because we've reached rock bottom. Do you think we've reached rock bottom in places in South Africa like Welkom? Places like Kwa Kwa? I mean, really? Or do you think there's still some, we can keep on digging? Do you think there's still room to keep digging?
So my problem is always the small towns reach the bottom first, right? These small, obscure towns on the side reach the bottom first. And you guys in the Johannesburgs and the metros reach the bottom way later than the rest of us. I went to Malutia Pofung. They reached the bottom. They took the ANC out, and the people who came in are just as bad. And so they are disgruntled with the party political system in general. They hate everyone because they're not getting what they deserve. And so I think, so my question is that, is it that we are all at this stage, or are there people still out here who still have hope, who are still saying, oh, maybe the DA can help me, or maybe XNSA can help? Because by the way things are looking now, nobody's really trying to help the average South African. And in most of these small towns, if you go there, like, you have these DA members. If you ask them any question, you see that these people have given up. They're just there at the council to get money. And so the alternatives are even failing. So I'm asking that because is the rest of South Africa feeling the same way? Are we all not fed up? Because right now, I think the person in Johannesburg values petrol more than they do anything else. If you're not getting petrol in Johannesburg and it's getting higher and higher, where are you really, right? Because people in Welkom, we could walk in any direction and we'll get to where we want to get to. And so everything is like an hour away from anything else. And so I'm thinking that the way in which our country is going now, we must be at the bottom because, one, we saw Cyril with this whole money laundering scheme that he calls a farm and auctions and all of that. And so the biggest problem with South Africans is we always suffer this whole, the emperor is naked. We know he's naked. We've seen him, right? We're all standing at the banquet. He's there in his undies, right? No, now what, right? And the second question is, if the emperor is naked in this way, who else do we run to? Because it doesn't even seem like South Africa is running to anyone else. It just seems like we're all just stuck here going, how do we move? Right? We're all, oh, well, it's the ANC. Oh, well, it's Eskom.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't have water. That worries me. That worries me a lot. Because if we're at the end of our wits about it, if we're really at rock bottom, we would be acting and saying, no, it's just me. I don't care. Let's just move on. Me and the people who are my neighbors, me and the people who I love, let's try to do something for ourselves. But right now, we're still looking to these people, thinking that there's some kind of outside help that's coming. And that's going to be the most dangerous part, I think, in the next coming 2 or 3 years. The fact that we're still hoping for somebody to come from up high and, you know, float down to us and try to help us.
So let's talk about this situation with Becky Taylor, because I think it expresses for many people the kind of frustration that you're talking about here, Lito. And it's a guy in a community policing forum in the Western Cape who's just had enough of Becky Taylor. The interesting thing about this clip is not just that he's shouting at the police minister, which we'd all like. Ian Cameron, I think, is his name. Shouting at Becky Taylor is also, it's instructive.
Wasn't.
What's that?
I don't think he was shouting. I mean, by the time I watched the clip, I'd seen quite a lot of comments. I heard on the radio when I was driving on one of the radio stations, they spoke about it and they, so I was quite interested to know who is this minister that's lost his shit and what went down. He is in a town hall and he is simply projecting. But he is extremely respectful.
Yes.
He is frustrated, but he is not rude.
Okay.
He is not.
Fair enough.
You know, no, you're right. Extremely,
okay. No, you are right.
I think Begicele, there's no way of seeing this other than Begicele lost his shit for no reason except for the fact that the truth is sharper than a double-edged sword.
Well, here it is. Here's the audio, which I want us to listen to, and you can decide for yourself. I'm not going to play the video because it's grainy and also it's a distraction. So rather listen to what this guy says and then listen to Begicele's like response to this. All right, so here it is.
James, she was murdered on the 8th of May in Khayelitsha. She was stabbed 100 meters from where six other people were shot 5 minutes earlier. No one followed up that case. We did, because her sister asked us to help. Do you know where we found the suspect? In the Eastern Cape. We brought him back. He is now being detained in Khayelitsha. We do that because we care for the community. We patrol for them. We give them training. I don't see you doing the same, sir. And I'm tired of the excuses, and I'm tired of you making this a political thing. None of these people tonight, when they see their neighbors being slaughtered on the streets, worry about your nonsense comments about the Constitution and about devolution. They worry about surviving, sir. And I would like to end off with this. I want to graciously invite you to come and patrol without a bodyguard, without a grand car, in normal clothes with this community tonight, to get the sewage on your shoes that they patrol through. You have a problem, Mr. Minister, because you are removed from reality that the rest of us face. When I visit Mbekweni, I get out of my car and a three-year-old little boy is taking a poo next to the road because he doesn't have a toilet. And you know what? Police don't care if something happens to them there because they don't have the resources to help. When I go to the different gender-based violence desks at these police stations, especially in the Nyanga cluster or traditional Nyanga cluster, the majority of the detectives have more than 300 dockets on their table. 300 dockets! How do you think you can do an investigation with 300 dockets? It's impossible. And then the cherry on top, and this is my conclusion, is that many of those detectives have 300 dockets, and it's a constable detective. He just came out of the college. He doesn't even know how to spell J88.
All right, so that's just a clip of him, which we haven't seen as much of that. I think a lot of people have been passing around the clip of Begicele losing his mind. But
I haven't seen that clip of Begicele losing his mind. But this man is respectful.
Yeah.
He's not even shouting. Mm. He's simply projecting. Apparently, he got like escorted off the premises by police.
That's true.
What the hell?
Yeah. Because he dared to stand up to Begicele and his, as he says, he's disconnected from reality. And I think that's the case for a lot of politicians. They don't live in the world that we live in.
Yeah, and you know, I think that was Begicele's, the reply that Begicele gave was indicative of the politicians of South Africa, right? It's the draft going into the nice Italian pants that he's wearing, and he's sort of feeling the small man syndrome. And he brings up all of these points where he wants to get conflict against this guy and not necessarily get the community what they need. And so he's trying to build up the conflict. That's why you hear some of the people also clapping hands when he says this. He says, no, but you were the ones who created this, and your parents and this and that and the apartheid. And I fought there, and I was in the cold water, blah, 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 blah.
All the shit nobody cares about.
In order to create, exactly, to create the conflict that he knows that the ANC thrives in. Because that's what they do. They thrive in the chaos of South Africa.
Do you want to,
and
do
that's
you,
what he tried to do in that venue.
Pums, do you want to hear his Bekele's little tirade, just so that you can have some context for that, and then we can talk about it. Do you want to hear it?
Okay.
All right, so here's Bekele lashing out at that guy that we just heard now.
Did not join human rights battles yesterday. That's why I was sent to prison. That's why I was sent to rob an island. That's why I lived in the cold water. That's why I ate bad food, because I was fighting for human rights. That's why today we have human rights. Don't teach me about human rights. Don't tell me and tell about the safety of my people. I fought for it. I nearly died for it. I was arrested for it. I was exiled for it. Don't provoke me. Don't talk things that you have studied and you have heard, you have been told about. I've lived this life.
By the way,
I've lived the life of being African.
He's wagging his finger while he's doing this.
When my mother was called a kitchen girl, when my father was called a garden boy, I've lived that life. And I'm not going to take any nonsense of somebody who regards me as a garden boy today, because you regard me as a garden boy. You come here, shut up! Shut up! Shut up! I sat here, I listened to you.
That's pretty much where it goes. I mean, I'm not going to carry on, but you can hear he actually
lost his unhinged.
Yeah, he started shouting "shut up" to this guy, and then they took him away. They took this guy away. They hauled him out of the room, and it's just outrageous that politicians are allowed to carry on like this. And I'm glad that he was rattled, and it shows you how thin their skins are. And
you know, I like it that he took everything out of the playbook. He put it all on the table.
My father's a garden boy. By the way, his father wasn't a garden boy. It's worth saying that his father worked for the railways. It's worth also noting that there are a couple of inconsistencies here. He tried the whole playbook. You know, you're calling me a garden boy. You studied this stuff. You don't experience it. And you heard that guy's walking around patrolling these neighborhoods. He's got more experience in policing than Bekele has ever had. And it all falls apart when you just dig a little bit deeper, right?
No. And also, here's, you know, the defining line for me is what they pull in poor communities with our people, right? I went to Robben Island. I worked for this. I nearly died for this, right? He even says, so you don't tell me about the safety of my people. He then says, you wouldn't have human rights if it were not for me.
For me. You owe me that. Yeah.
So he's not talking to him at that time. He's talking to the black people around him.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, you don't listen to him. Mm-hmm. You owe me for this.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I've done for you.
Right.
I'm black. I'm you. I nearly died for you. I'm Jesus.
Yeah, you owe me.
Clap hands for Jesus.
Yeah.
He said, you owe me. And so when he does that, this is what the politician in South Africa does. They love conflict. They love us fighting. Excuse me. And they love us angry.
Yeah.
And that's what he was doing.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, also, you know, there's deep like insecurity if you scratch a little bit beneath the surface with a lot of these politicians, because the minute you call them out on their bullshit, it becomes like a personal thing. They play the man instead of the ball, which is always a sign that the argument is being won by the side that isn't playing the man and is just playing the ball, which is exactly what we see happening here. I like that he was rattled. I like that this happened. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing to witness. And I hope many South Africans have seen it and that they can all see through all the nonsense that we've been sold. I love this idea of the savior, like, you owe me, I'm the Jesus. It's such nonsense.
Right, and I think the people who are helping our poor people, right, must also be careful when they dunk on the government like he did, because to some point there are people in our communities who still buy the trash from the government, right? Because you heard people clap, somebody is shouting "Boo!" Tell him, right? So we need to be careful when doing those things, because now the person who's helping is partially seen as the villain, because Mr. Jesus Pants here has said he's Jesus. And so I think, and his tactic was even though his methods and the reason why he was doing it were justified, I think the saddest part was the minister got to do what he wanted to do, was to detract from the crimes that are happening in the community, from the women. Like, that guy was talking about a woman in May who got dismembered.
Yeah.
They went and found the killer who dismembered a woman.
Yes.
Who raped her, killed her, cut her arms and legs off.
Yeah.
And so, and these filthy politicians get to come to these communities and soil the names of those people. And I think more and more those people should reach out to communities and find intermediaries. Because you can hear him. It's when people are at the most desperate point where they go seek out the NPOs, the NGOs, right? And not on a regular basis, where the government now can start to feel the pressure. I think if there's an intermediary between the community and those people who want to help the community, it would be such a smoother process. And we wouldn't even, I don't think people would have attended that that summit that they had if the communities and the NGOs and NPOs were doing it themselves. Because the reason why that young man stood up, right, is because Begit Kelle started by disrespecting him. He says to him, I don't even know who you are, because for me, the real CPFs is the CPFs that we talk about as the police. You're not the CPF, which doesn't make sense, right? Because everyone is trying to decrease the crime. It doesn't matter if the police give you a yellow jacket or not.
It's also because the guy's white. Let's not mess around. It's also because the guy's white.
I think... And it's one of the things that you wanted to talk about today is about just the reflection on society. And I know it was linked to Enyo Beni, but I think it also falls into this particular discussion. It's about the society in which we live in, right? So there are quite a lot of different factors that are also about the brokenness of our society. So not just, Begit Kelle is unhinged. He's a warlord. He's ineffective. He is terrible at what he does. We know all of these things. I mean, the man was so bad, he was fired by Jacob Zuma. But, you know, in all his wisdom, our president brought him back. But there really is a whole other spectrum around the communities within which we live and the interpersonal relationships in those communities, even before you bring in the NGOs. I know you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, and because our society is so conflicted, right? The conflict has defined us. I was talking to a colleague yesterday in the afternoon, and we were talking about how everyone wants to put the context based on color, based on everything else. And so that's why everyone wants to have a little grain of salt, right? My colleague even said he's suspicious of Gift of the Givers, for instance. He says, why is it just Indians in that organization?
My God, really?
Even though they're helping everyone. Jesus. Yes, because the context of color is so disgustingly dragged into everything in this country.
Yeah.
It drags itself in places where you actually don't need it. And so that's why I think even when we try to get into conflict with these politicians, because they have nothing to offer. And that's what hurts me the most, that the people with nothing to offer, we give them a chance to enter the conversation. We must now show them that they're isolated, because outside of the ANC or these politicians, people of South Africa can do these things themselves and can be self-reliant. And so by dunking on them in this situation or trying to include them in the conversation, we, in fact, bring them into a place where they're irrelevant. And so I think holding them into that periphery and at times holding them to account is actually doing the work that they can't. I think that's where the accountability is.
Yeah, but
where you hear this guy says they brought a criminal from the Eastern Cape back to the Western Cape.
How do we get past this thing that you just brought up now, where someone will say, oh, well, I don't know so much about Gift of the Givers because they run by Indians, so how can we trust them? Or you see Bekele treating this guy like he's not a member of the CPF just because he's the white guy in the room. And I think he was the only white guy in that room, by the way. How do we stop people from thinking this way? Because this is the poison. This is what the politicians use. This is their leverage, right? This is how they make you think, well, if it's a white person, if it's a colored person, if it's a black person, if it's an Indian person, your whole thinking must change around this. I thought the whole point of 1994 and everything that has come since was that we would stop seeing people that way. It seems to have gone the opposite direction in some ways.
The whole point of 1984 was supposed to be that. But if it is actually that, then South Africans would actually bring about our South African solutions, right? We would firstly burn these damn businessmen, we'd burn the damn politicians, and we'd be relying on ourselves. And so I think the first step in doing that, I think, is that the problem is the skills that take care of our problems are outside of our communities sometimes, right? And the problem is when those skills come to our communities, they come from the people that we were told not to trust, right? And when you are bringing solutions, so let's assume you are Gareth and you're bringing a solution. Mm-hmm. You don't come to a solution and say, trust me first. You assume that people would intrinsically flow towards the solution. The people in need would flow towards the solution, but normal people who are still under the guise of don't trust Gareth because he's white would then doubt your intentions before anything else. And so that's why I say, if anyone from an NGO or an NPO is listening, if you want to go into a community, find an intermediary who would help you translate each other's one differences, but also your problems to each other, in order for you guys to also become a community. Because becoming a community is not about where you live, what you look like, who you are, but it's the actions that you take for each other. What are you willing to do for each other in order to become better, right? Mm-hmm. And I think these two things aren't happening. When Gift of the Givers comes, they come at emergency times, right? And when they leave, somebody can then say, but these Indians, they're always here trying to flex on us. It's because they have money. It's because they live in this neighborhood. And so we still don't understand each other's point of view as South Africans, and we don't regard that as important because the politicians want us to think it's not there anymore, right? Yeah. And then so you'll have they'll tell you that the millennials don't see color. None of that. Throw all of that away. See color. And talk towards that color and talk it away. Because the more we talk, the more we interact, the less we see about color or the different places where you were put by the apartheid government to live. We'll start seeing each other as human beings.
So, echoing, I think Robert Sobukwe, and I saw somebody in the comments as well, one of his most quoted lines, Robert Sobukwe, is about that there's only one race. The human race. Mm. And one of the things that as South Africans, we have been exploited against us, all of us South Africans, is really the issue that our differences are so much less than the things that keep us, that make us the same, yeah. Right? So the conversations that are being had, and this is what you see and what you hear, is people who are desperately clinging on to a power that they feel slipping away from them.
Yeah.
This is why you hear Bekele fighting so hard to be loved and accepted as this person that has. And it's not just Bekele. I mean, we saw it at the beginning of the year. Lindiwe Sisulu wrote a huge op-ed. Right, has been in government since she was 40 or something ridiculous, like since Nelson Mandela, and here she is suddenly kind of feeling like, hey South Africa, hey Mzansi, have we seen justice yet? And all of those differences that get exploited really do pull us apart further from each other. What's amazing for me, and this year, I've traveled more in communities outside of the urban areas. As in those places, people don't see those other people. We were in Malamulele The kids growing up in Malamulele do not have a race problem. Why? Because they don't see people of other races. They really don't. They understand that their problem is not having water or not being able to get to school because the river has flooded and there is no bridge. So, you know, but also kind of here in the centers. So even in Welkom, you are in a bit of a center because you get access. You get access to the news. You get access to the outrage, the internet, as intermittent as it is. And so the conversations that are being had in those spaces also confirm those biases that we all have, right? Because we started earlier talking about getting different ideas from different people, because those confirmations are, if you surround yourself only with people who have the similar experience to you, then you just have the same things that you complain about, right? And when you in a community like the community in that town hall, and suddenly you see these six big flashy cars arriving, it's very difficult for when Begicele has left for that community to keep hating on an Ian Cameron who is part of their community, who they see every day, who words alongside them, who helps them get the solutions.
So in other
kind
words,
of bridging,
I mean,
that gap.
Yeah, and I mean, Pums, that's quite a hopeful story, because what it means is that in the end, these guys cannot win because they just don't have the ability to be there every day reminding us of the hatred and trying to stoke the ugliness. Ultimately, we will win if we do stick together. But I mean, you've just been to rural KwaZulu-Natal. You've just been to Ngqothu. Just tell us, how does that differ from the experience of people either in urban centers like us when we live here, and how does it differ from people like Lieto, who's in the Free State? I mean, is there much of a difference?
I don't think the difference is very much to Lieto's experience in the Free State, but I will tell you that the conversations we have in Joburg, on Twitter, on the radio, those conversations are not the conversations being had out there. There was a by-election. There were two by-elections yesterday, one in Nelson Mandela Bay and one in Tsikama, I think. Mm-hmm. And you know, Gareth, you and I will rage about not having electricity, having intermittent electricity. We will rage about having water having the water cut off every 3 days. Yep. That is because we lived in a world where all of those things have always worked. And we can, and I also saw with somebody on Twitter with a journalist, with a Sunday Times journalist, talking about how these things are like, you know, they're like air. They just are. Mm. But, and that's why I give you the example of a Malamulele or even a Ngqothu. Today, when they have electricity 3 out of 7 days, it is still better than where they come from, where they had no electricity every day. You know what I'm saying? So the distorted view of it is, oh, so the electricity is not on today, but no, I still have it 3 times a week, whereas before I've never had it at all. You know, and that's the conversation that needs to be had. And we often have the conversation here where I say, unfortunately, what the opposition parties fail at is having the conversation that will convert people in the places where they need to be had in order to have a majority, right? So it's not enough to only be having these conversations in the newspapers or on the news on TV. If you're not on the ground, Lieto, to the point that you're making, that is, even NGOs, you need to become part of this community. You need to understand each other. You need to speak with each other or have somebody translate your intentions and your actions for the person on the other side. But, you know,
can I just,
if we don't do that, we won't win. If we don't do that, we won't win.
I want to refer to one of the comments here from Siyabonga, who says, and Siyabonga is a new commenter. You know, we have lots of people. They always said to us in radio, you only 1% of your audience actually engages and interacts. I think that might have gone up since the dawn of social media. But it's true nonetheless that we get some interesting insights from the comment section, and there are always people who have kind of the same point of view and repeat themselves. But Siyabonga is new, and he says, let's not forget about the media, who tried to portray Ian Cameron as an unruly, privileged white guy instead of showing the good things he's done for the neglected black community and the great person that he is. I think the point here is, just like he was saying to Becky Cele, come and patrol with us, why don't the media, who are happy to show like a fight between Becky Cele and some guy in the neighborhood, why don't they go on patrol with this dude? Why don't the media do the hard work either? Because they don't want to get their expensive shoes dirty either, do they? They don't want to walk through sewage. None of the media are interested in portraying community heroes. They would much rather show a race fight, a conflict. That gets them ratings. And who's actually going to watch this guy on his patrols at night if they do film him? Probably not a lot of people. So maybe it comes down to us, not the media. Do you think that that's a valid point bring up?
But I think not even about us or the media, right? So for this one, I blame you, Gareth, right? You, DJs Wu, Mac G, because the media now is reverting back to its basic nature, right? Because you guys are whipping them all over this internet. And so they then need to sell the basics, sex, violence, conflict.
Oh, you mean we're doing this to the mainstream media?
Yes, because the mainstream media now is afraid to do deep dives, right? Because, like you say, they're afraid of the possibility of people not watching, right? And so what they would do then, it's easier to then say, hey, white guy talks to black guy about black people not getting crime solved, right?
Yeah.
It gets such a small caveman, narrow view.
Reptile
that
brain.
It's the violence, exactly. So that the violence is exactly all that we need to do. Let's just focus on the violence between the whites and the blacks. But actually, the deeper story there is how a minister, somebody with all the power to solve crime, to help communities, is actually getting solutions. Because that guy gave him solutions. He said, we need you to help with training. We need you to help employ these people. Because that's what he was saying. He says, you can't have 300 cases as a detective. That just shows you that you can employ more people to come and help with investigations.
Right.
We are here to help you. We are here to show you the talented people. But our government hates talented people. It hates talented black people, to be specific.
Well, because they
talented black people
make them look bad.
Yes. And also it makes them, it takes away from the Jesus, right?
I'm
now the Jesus I need.
I think you just,
and so you just, he tell us no longer Jesus.
You just hit the nail on the head. So, I mean, if you're not a talented person, then talented people are a threat to you. And if being a black and talented is even more threatening, that means that all you've got is the black part. And that's exactly what Becky Taylor was showing us in that interaction. So I don't want us to be completely obsessed with just this one thing. Can we also please refer, and Pumzi, you can have the last word on this, but I do want us to move on to Enyo Benny, because there's a lot about that story that still bothers me. You know, there are a couple of stories in the past 5 to 10 years that really bother me. One of them is still the Marikana situation, which we've never really got to the bottom of. And we've brought this up, and I don't want to sound like a broken record. The other one is the this Enyo Benny thing, which is new, and then that situation where all those people who had severe mental health problems were put into homes where they weren't looked after. What was it called? The
Life as Demen.
Thank you. Quite right. Those three stories have bothered me because there's no good on the one side of those stories. It's all bad on the one side of those stories. And yet, we're still prevaricating over whether or not X person must be sent to jail, whether Y person must be held responsible. We know in all of these situations that there are at least one group of people who are definitely on the bad side, whether it's law enforcement, in the case of this Enyo Benny tavern situation, whether it's the owner of the tavern. And I know we like to blame people. And Pumi, you said it last week. We need to have a savior and we need to have a bad guy. But really, in these situations, I feel like it's kind of clear. You know, where you have children dying in this most recent situation, you have the most vulnerable people with huge mental problems and emotional problems and developmental problems in the Life Estimeni situation. And in Marikana, where you have completely disempowered mine workers. They have the hardest job in the world. They're going underground. They got treated like absolute shit, and then the police opened fire on them. I mean, it just seems to me like these are cut and dried, now someone must go to jail situations, and nothing's happened in all three of them.
So you know, first, I do want to say, sorry, Leah, I do want to say, just finishing off with the Nyanga conversation, the Bekicele conversation, is that the real hero of that situation is also the person with their cell phone taking all these video clips and sending them out, right? Because we would never have seen it to the point of, you know, Bekicele. What I heard was the minister got unhinged because of until I saw the videos on social media, no one really got what the full story was. And Ian Cameron was almost relegated to being an unruly white guy somewhere, you know, in the hood.
Now people are taking notice. That's you're right. Okay, but let's talk about Enyo Beni. What does this tell us about ourselves?
Right. You know, the part that broke me, like I really didn't want to follow the story that much. The part that broke me was when an SABC reporter went and had an interview with the wife of the tavern owner. And this woman sat there and said to the reporter, "Oh, you wanted me to close the tavern because children are coming here. So how must we live? So me and my husband must die of hunger." And so that question got me out of my mind, right? That this person knows what's happening in her tavern is wrong. She knows it, right? And then her justification is, "Oh, well, I'm hungry. Hey, man, the world is fucking me over too, so somebody else must get fucked over. What do I care?" And I was so saddened by that. Is where are we living right now, right? Where children go to a tavern and everyone is, we're sad because it happened. And it's a sad situation. We're sad because children die. And it's always a travesty when children die in such a manner. But how did we get to a point where children were all confined in a damn tavern? I mean, this place is reputed there. Like, if the owner reaches his target, he gives out a certain brand of alcohol for free to the children. If a child passes out, they say, "No, don't give them water. Here's this one specific drink and give it to them." And so we are in a place now where we must start talking about how the things we put on social media and the things we're all portraying as cool and fancy, how that's affecting our children, right? I remember once, it was way back when you were at the SABC, Gareth, you gave us a statistic that we're one of the highest beer-consuming countries in the world, right? I was very young then, and I was still alarmed by that. I'm alarmed by it now, is that we sort of seem to brag about it. Even during the pandemic, people were telling you how, I'm willing
They're
to buy...
They're making pineapple beer.
Yes, I'm willing to buy an alcoholic beverage at 100 times the cost because, hey, I have to live by this thing. We can't live without it. And so that is now slowly creeping into the lives of our children. They're starting to see that as normal in South Africa. And I think the normalization of this immoral actions, of these immoral actions, but also the condoning of those immoral actions. So I'm not even just saying the tavern owner, because one of the mothers said, or of the deceased kids, "Oh, I was concerned when my child didn't
the
come
dad.
Knocking around.
The yes, dad.
When my child didn't come knocking at the door around 1 a.m. as they usually do on Saturday evening." I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about, dog? Why is your 13-year-old out at 1 a.m.? What is happening?" And so it seems like a deep moral decay that we're not taking care of, that we're not having a conversation about, because it's an unpopular conversation. Mm-hmm. I've been watching these media outlets all throughout the week, and nobody has been talking about that.
No one.
Why, as a society, are we accepting kids going to a tavern and that being the good time of the tavern?
I agree with you about the tavern owner. There's a huge degree of responsibility there. But this thing about making the parents not responsible, you know, because either they live in a township or they're poor, or we've got this idea of the virtuous poor in South Africa and in the world. And we never, it's almost what I call the, well, it's what a lot of people would call the low expectation. Oh, hang on, I've just gone completely blank. The low bigotry the low bigotry of soft expectations, where
the bigotry of soft expectations.
What you do is you essentially patronize people because they're poor and perhaps they're uneducated, and you think, well, let's not blame them. Now, these are parents. The parents have to be the first line of defense for their children, and if your children enter into a lifestyle or enter into a venue or enter into a form of behavior which is dangerous for them, the first person to stand in the way of that happening should be the parent. I'm not a parent. Pumi, you're the only one. Lito, you have children? No. So, nope. Pumi, you're the only one who can speak here as a parent. But for some reason, we, and again, I agree with Lito, the media have been completely derelict in not paying attention to the parents and their responsibilities in all of this. It's all about the tavern owner. It's all about the police in the area. It's all about the neighborhood watch. It's got nothing. Where are these parents?
But last week when I said the problem is everybody in the cycle, right? It's not just
no, but
the parents.
But the problem when we do that,
when we do that, though,
we don't actually identify the culprit because we're now spreading blame.
Hear me out, like Alec Irwin
used to do about Eskom. Remember that.
So hear me out on this,
sure.
Right? And this is why it's important for me to understand the entire cycle. And all of the individuals that are in here, you can start at the home with the parent and you can say, where are these parents, right? Where are these parents and why are they not looking after these children? And if I put to you that same, this is a single parent home or even a dual income, two parents in this home who look after these kids and they work every day or 7 days a week. This happened on a Saturday night, I think, right? And there are some people who work right through the week and get Thursdays off instead of a Saturday or a Sunday or any other time, and are working from a country to country, have to travel to work, therefore leave their kids at home early in the morning to get to work by 8 sure. o'clock and come sure. back late at night, and therefore are not there to be able to monitor those kids and see where those kids are all of the time. Then you ask yourself, where are the grandparents and why are they not assisting? Where are the aunts? Where's the extended family right. in this situation?
I mean, you were, right? you're a good
or
parent.
Or even the community.
You're a good parent. You try to look after your son the best way you can, and you work hard. I mean, this is, again, the soft bigotry of low expectations.
And it's fucking irritating.
Let's not make excuses for these people.
No. It is not making excuses. It is simply saying, and this is why I'm saying to you, you've got to understand all of these things in the system, right? You have a tavern owner who has supposedly got a liquor license, which supposedly has some kind of guidelines of where to be, how many hours to be open, who they can serve alcohol to, which is a tavern in the middle of a residential area. How is that part of liquor license rules, right? Where is the community? When the police, and so their license agreement is X and they do not stick to that, and there is no law enforcement to make them stick to that. This is the entire cycle of events. And let us not forget, guys, let's not behave like we were never teenagers. Teenagers are insane and incredible, and they will try their luck with everything. People have stories, and I think the things that we saw kind of coming out, people have stories where their parents had sent them to boarding school because they were not going to be, and people made skeleton keys of the boarding house this and then you know, so all of these things come on, right? All of these things are part of that. However, and when you are in this situation, everybody that has a blame to take, that blame must be apportioned to those people. The kids, the parents, the community, the tavern owner, the liquor license giver, the police who do not show up, all of them.
Yeah, it's the bottom falling out of the bucket, right? Everyone who should have done something failed dismally, right? Because I'm even saying that, like the parents, but now the problem is this, we're not having that proper conversation, Pumi.
Yeah.
We're just having it about the one and not the other, right? Because I was thinking about myself, right? I know I'm selfish about it, but we in my neighborhood there in the township, there's an open field where all the older boys, so me and the other guys, the Nyaupe boys, the people who don't work, we're all like, no, let's all get our shovels from home and let's make a field for the kids, right? That every afternoon, the one Nyaupe boy who used to know how to play soccer will buy him some beer after practice. He'll practice the kids. And then when he's done with that, we'll buy you 2 or 3 beers. That's the responsibility of the young guys who work and the young guys who don't work. We are going to make sure that the little kids know at least how to play soccer on the afternoons, right? And so even that failed, right? Because apparently, if you go to that place, there's nothing for kids to do. There's no park. There's no place. There's nothing else. And so everything that could have fallen apart has fallen apart in that society. But
sports has been taken out of the school system. Public schools don't have any sports.
And so my issue is that if and when that happens in other places, because it could happen. Now we've seen that it could happen, that everything that can fail has failed. How do we start to redress that? Simply on a moralistic basis, like on a moral fiber basis, to say, as a community, what are we not willing to accept? That the one guy in the community who's the loudmouth can go to that tavern and keep saying to that guy, hey, but my nigga, what are you doing? Why do you keep letting these people in? You understand? Can we not start building that? Because if we don't, this could occur more and more. And it won't just be kids next time. It will be another kind of disaster that we are not aware of, that we think is the cool thing until people die.
Well, the one thing I think we'll all agree is that there is no place for attention-seeking politicians at funerals for children like this. There is no reason that Cyril Ramaphosa should find his way to... And if I were a parent of these children, this would add insult to injury. This would not be a comfort. You know, these politicians who cloak themselves in the idea that they're there to comfort the bereaved. I mean, I can't imagine a worse thing than a politician arriving if I'd lost my child in a tragedy like this. I find it all just so tasteless and ugly. And yet, he arrives, and then, Pumi, you pointed out earlier, he fell asleep.
Yay.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Midway through everything.
Jesus.
Talking about a systemic failure, the entire infrastructure around the president is also failing him here. Because really, is there nobody there making sure that, listen, Mr. President, you're going to be at a long funeral in the hot sun. You should have a nap on your way there so that you're not falling asleep in front of the cameras. But hell, why is there nobody saying, why the hell are you going to this funeral? Why the hell are you going to this funeral? It reminded me, Lieto, you were talking earlier about kind of the, I did this, I went to exile, all of those old images. It reminded me of the old imagery that we used to see a lot of in the 80s of the mass funerals, you know, the 15 coffins.
I remember those.
Lined up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It reminded me of that. And I was just like, what are these people doing?
Whoever got the tender for that state funeral also wanted to do the tacky thing of making all the coffins look the same. It sickened me. I was sitting at home, almost scratching my eyes out. It was so cringeworthy. They took over the whole process. You know, the process of the community going back to the home, sitting with you, eating with you, trying to help you through this. Oh, no. We have little government packets for you. Just sit where you are. We're going to take the caskets away to where the funeral is going to be held. I'm like, no. That's not what you need at that moment. That's not what the community needs. That's not what the country needs. That's not what those people need. Get out of the way so people can do what they do to mourn. No, they're there trying to take everything over because a tender was given out. It was sickening.
All right, so can we quickly?
It was awful.
We've got like a minute or two left, and I'd loved us to.
We didn't even get to talk about Boris Johnson and her and the people resigning, guys.
I watched a bit of this before my power went out last night. I saw a little bit of him being questioned by that parliamentary committee. Yo, but they had a go at each other, and
I must tell you,
I mean, if I were Boris Johnson, I must tell you, I really admire. I've always thought he was a bit of a buffoon, and I liked it when he wrote for GQ about cars and women and things like that. But I've always thought that Boris was completely out of his depth as a prime minister. But I have to say, after watching him being taunted, interrogated, and cajoled like he was yesterday by these people, the way he maintained his cool was unbelievable. I would have lashed out and jumped over that table and physically attacked some of these men who were questioning him. Jesus, he was so cool and calm. And I mean, clearly they didn't throw him out last night because that was the talk before my power went out and then I decided to go to bed, that they were going to actually have him recalled.
A vote of no vote of no confidence.
What they did to John Major.
But
I think they're having break room channel chats about him resigning.
That's the only
way he could survive this. I mean, he could survive this.
If he refuses to resign, he's going to survive because the next vote of no confidence must be triggered in the next 12 months from now because he's just had one.
Right.
So he can't do it now.
Oh, okay. Is that
so
how it works?
That's the loophole that's saving him, yeah. Huh. So it's either that they frustrate him to a point of resignation.
Jesus.
But I think he still, after last night, he got a few fans. He was toughing it out so well last night that I did sort of clap for him and go, yeah, under the circumstances, yeah. But, you know, his mouth sometimes gets him into so much trouble and sometimes gets him out of so much trouble.
Yeah.
He's got a very bad relationship with words. I just had to say.
Well, listen, I appreciate your time this morning, Leto. It's always good to have you on the show, and thank you for your insights today. Slightly less frustrating than some of the occasions where we talk, not because you are being frustrating, but because there's so few answers to our ongoing questions and to our problems. I hope we get to chat again soon, and thank you for your participation. And obviously to everybody in the comments, sorry we didn't get to all of them. There were some very, very interesting and valuable comments and some comments that I've just ignored. But we'll we'll continue this conversation next week. For me.
Oh, so you ignore some of them.
Ignore some of them. I did. I'm the Becky Keller here. Shut up. We will see you next Thursday for another Burning Platform, but we'll see you tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Cheers, everybody. Have a happy day. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.